Obviously, good to be with you all again, and it's always lovely to come and share with you, and it's always nice when I see on the plan that I'm at Himley Road, so lovely to come and spend time with you again. And it is a bit miserable this morning, but I'm going to share with you some of my holiday snaps this morning as well, so we'll have that. Am I too much for everybody? Yeah. He's just too much, that guy. Yeah. Right, okay, well, we're just going to read a few verses from Exodus chapter 2, okay? So I think most of you got it right, didn't you? Because there seem to be lots of hands going up for the Old Testament. I saw somebody a few weeks ago, and I'd been preaching on Daniel chapter 12, and he said to me, "Are you still banging on about the second coming?" As you do. And I said, "Well, this morning I actually preached from Daniel chapter 12. And he said, "Good, nice to hear that you're doing something different." Well, of course, Daniel chapter 12 is about the second coming anyway. So it was a little test of his biblical knowledge. Anyway, we're going to do Exodus 32. We'll just read a few verses here, and it's the golden calf. And as you remember, the story goes that Moses is up in the mountains. He's been gone a long time, so they decide to do things their way and default back to the olden days and the things that they used to know. And they make, of course, a golden calf. Moses comes down incredibly annoyed, breaks the tablets, you know, God's annoyed and everything else. So it really is a sad situation. But this morning, try and understand what God is trying to do here in these circumstances. So I'll read it through and then we'll stop at an appropriate point. So I'll take it from here. So it says, "When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, 'Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him.' Aaron answered them, 'Take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me.' So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron." We'll have the next slide, please, as Chris Whitty used to say. There we are. "He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioned it with a tool. Then they said, 'These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt.'" What a thing to say. "When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, 'Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord.' So the next day, the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterward, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Go down, because your people, who you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, 'These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt.' I have seen these people," the Lord said to Moses, "and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation." But Moses sought favor of the Lord. Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. "Lord," he said, "why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand?" We'll leave it there. We'll pray. Heavenly Father, we ask as we turn to your word now, and we see the horrendous situation that the people of Israel had created, very quick to turn away from God and to lose confidence in him. Lord, forgive us when we perhaps sometimes are quick to lose confidence in you. Lord, we pray that you would help us now to understand your ways, in the name of Jesus. Amen. Amen. Okay, well, we'll have a look at that. And it's a sad, sorry situation and set of circumstances. Now, we've got some slides this morning. So I think the slides are going to come up, and then I'm going to attempt to control them somehow. There we are. Right. We're going to look at the law of Moses. And it says there, when the people saw that Moses was so long coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this man, Moses, who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him. Right, okay, well, let's have a look. Am I going the right way? Try that way. Oh, now that was the thing you told me to do, wasn't it? Switch it on. There we are. If all else fails, read the instructions, as they say. Let's have a go. Ah. Moses was up in the mountain, wasn't he? And there was chaos going on down below, wasn't there? There was defiance. I mean, as you just read some of that, it just feels awful, doesn't it? After everything that God's done, you know, they're actually forgetting all of that and saying, let's build something and say, that's the one that set us free. Climbing mountains. It made me think about climbing mountains with Moses up on the mountain. Here's a question. Does anybody know which mountain that is? Cadaridaris, yes. If you said Snowdon, you're not far away because it's in Snowdonia. Anyway, that's Cadaridaris. Well, I thought as it's rainy and miserable, I'll share one of my holiday snaps or two. And there we are. In August, I had the opportunity to climb up Cadaridaris. Has anybody else climbed up Cadaridaris? John, I thought you were going to say yes. Some while ago. Oh, at the back as well. Anybody else? I'm obviously the 12th person here to have climbed up Cadaridaris. There we are. So there we are, Cadaridaris. And of course, it's got that huge lake there. And you climb up. Now, there were quite a few people climbing up on the day that I went. And we stopped at about this point here. And there were some people from Switzerland. And I thought they know more about climbing mountains than any of us. And they said, there we are, we've got to the top, we've got to that point there, this is the top of Cadaridaris. And I had to point out to them, I think you'll probably find that bit up there, that's the top of Cadaridaris. So, of course, we climbed all the way up there. There we go. There's me with my two sons, Matthew and Luke. If you're wondering who I am, I'm that little tiny person right in the middle there that you can hardly see, who's probably a bit flushed and probably needs to have some angina tablets. Sorry? Would you believe that I was the person who was carrying the heaviest rucksack with all the drinks in it? I thought I've somehow got this wrong, but no, they were fine. It took us 3 hours and 5 minutes to climb all the way up to the top of Cadaridaris. I bet those of you that have done it faster than that, haven't they? And of course, it's basically just one step after another, going up and up and up into the mountain. Now, here we met a very, very brave sheep. When the Lord talks about sheep, we think, you know, we're sheep, we're meek, we're mild, we won't cause any trouble for anybody. In fact, we're more likely to run off, aren't we? What happens to a sheep when you're walking towards it? It will run off, won't it? Well, this sheep was the bravest sheep I've ever met in my life. And I encountered him when I was eating my sandwiches, and suddenly this creature is right in my face and was basically going round taking everybody's food. A dog had a go at him as well, and he took the dog on, which I have to say, I have never seen a sheep do that. But I suppose if you live at the top of Cadaridris, you can be pretty brave, can't you? So there we are. Well, of course, thinking about that, you know, and the mountains, started to think about Moses climbing up Mount Sinai. And as you can see there, I thought we'd compare Mount Sinai to Cadaridris. And you don't do that very often, but there we are. Cadaridris is just 2,900 feet high, but of course Mount Sinai is 7,400 feet high, so much, much bigger, much higher. And of course there Moses received the Ten Commandments and the law, and Moses went up seven, possibly eight times. Now me, as a 35-year-old, you know, or thereabouts, you'll know I'm lying, went up, you know. Moses, as an 80-year-old, went up seven or eight times to receive the Ten Commandments. And, of course, on this occasion, when he was up there in the mountain receiving the law of God, receiving all of those things, the people were in chaos and idolatry down below. Well, thinking about mountains, we'll just move on to the next one there. How's that? When you climb a mountain, of course, the journey can be hard work. What's the most dangerous bit of climbing a mountain? Coming down. Yes, because you're likely to slip and break something. So coming down a mountain is the most dangerous bit. Moses, of course, that hard journey climbing up into the mountains, all of those steps required. Some ancient traditions say that the angel that led them, that same angel also helped Moses up and down the mountain. I like to think about that because God doesn't leave us alone, does he? He will send help. So there we are, he had assistance. The horizon isn't always at the top. Now, those of you that have climbed up, you see the horizon at the top, and what happens when you get to the top of the horizon? There's another one. And you say, well, surely that next one, that must be it. And you get to the top of there, and there's another one, you know. So sometimes we may be going through difficult circumstances, and we might say, well, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel now. And, of course, that's not always the case, is it? And life's journey can sometimes be hard work. But, of course, when you get to the top of the mountain and you get to the peak there and you have your photograph taken and everything else, then you can say it's a satisfying experience, isn't it? 15,000 steps right the way up, down, for those of you that count your steps. There we are. It can be satisfying when achieved. And, of course, the wonderful thing is that it's an achievement that can be shared. So when we go through difficulties or when we climb mountains and we get to the other side, it can be satisfying when achieved. And of course, it's always wonderful to share with others your achievements and your testimonies and your experiences, isn't it? So there we are. What can we learn from climbing mountains? There we have those wonderful words in Psalm 121. Lift up my eyes, I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. So there's something about mountains, isn't there, and the Christian faith. There's something about looking upwards to the horizon. Well, that's my holiday snaps. Let's just bring the next one up. Just going to have a few minutes looking at the law of Moses. Now, I like this one. This, if you like, almost sums up Old Testament law, doesn't it? An eye for an eye, this is Exodus 21, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot, a burn for a burn, a wound for a wound, a bruise for a bruise. Sounds a bit heavy to us in 2024, doesn't it? What about forgiveness? What about turning the other cheek? What about building bridges? What about, you know, trying to find a way forward? And of course, a lot of people will have said it to you and they've said it to me in the past as well. They say, I don't like the God of the Old Testament. He's a God of vengeance. He's a God of bloodshed. He's a God of war and death and all the rest of it. And, you know, sometimes we may struggle to answer some of those questions. Jesus, of course, when he came onto the earth, summarized and epitomized all of that there in Mark 12, with love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. There's no greater commandment than this. And of course, what we see here through these chapters of Exodus is that God is gradually trying to move his people away from the world that they knew. The world that they knew was a world of vengeance, wasn't it? Dog eat dog, get them before they get you. If they take an eye, you take an eye. But, you know, in those days as well, vengeance, an out-of-control vengeance, was the way that they perceived law to operate. You know, if a king didn't like the look of you, or you looked at them a certain way, he could have you killed just because he didn't like the way you looked at him. If you scratched somebody on the arm with your blade just by mistake, they could have you killed, your family killed, your friends killed, completely disproportionate to anything that we would understand today. So God was gradually trying to move them away from that primitive, vengeance-driven approach to life to law, order, justice, balance. If you take an eye, the equivalent of an eye is the maximum that you can take back. Still a little strange to us in this day and age, but there we see that God is starting to try to bring some order to these people's lives. These people had lived in slavery. They'd only ever known slavery, their situation. God was trying to bring them out of that situation. So let's just have a look. Hang on, we're going too far. Hang on. This is like me trying to operate the remote at home. Not very well. Okay. And of course, it also says there in Exodus 21, if you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years, and on the seventh year, he shall go free without paying anything. Laws relating to servants and even slavery. We know of slavery and modern slavery problems and all of that kind of thing. But, you know, some of this doesn't really attach to us, and we don't understand the concept always so well these days. But we see the impact of exploiting people and what that can mean. But what the Lord was trying to lay down here, what these Israelite people couldn't do because they'd known about slavery generation after generation after generation, and what they couldn't do is to say, we have spent lifetimes in slavery, generation after generation after generation, we're going to make sure that other people do the same as we've done. They couldn't do that any longer. They would have to operate principles that were appropriate. So here's Moses. He climbed up the mountain several times. Moses has traveled a huge distance physically. He is different. He is older. Spiritually, he is different. He is greater. And the Israelite people had traveled that same journey with him. However, there were still more lessons to learn. And as we could see, they were making mistakes there. Interesting also, when he talks about the law, it says in Exodus 21, anyone who strikes a person with a fatal blow is to be put to death. However, if it is not done intentionally, but God lets it happen, they are to flee to a place that I will designate. There were about six designated places. So in other words, if you by mistake killed somebody. You didn't intend to do it. It wasn't premeditated murder, but you'd killed them by mistake. The family may still want to come after you and kill you, hadn't they? So you could go to a designated place that was controlled by the Levites where you would be protected. Now, we know in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not commit murder. Premeditated murder is wrong as far as the law is concerned. But if it happens by mistake, it says there, God takes responsibility for that situation. So if you were chopping down a tree in the woods and somebody was walking along in the woods, not particularly looking where they were going, and the tree landed on their head, and one minute they're walking in the woods, the next minute they're face to face with the Lord, it says God takes responsibility for letting that happen. So in other words, you can't beat yourself up for something that hasn't been created by your hand. But premeditated murder is different. Or, of course, you know, if we take today, you could be crossing the road, not looking right, looking left, looking right again. What was it? Stop, look, listen. Green cross code. Just went out and you got run over. It would say, God let that happen. Or you got yourself into that position. That nearly happened to me many years ago, where when I hadn't long started driving, and the car that I had was incredibly cheap. In fact, the brakes were the only decent thing on the vehicle. I was driving along. It was by St. Peter's in Upper Gornal, and I was just driving along, following the speed limit, minding my own business, and then suddenly an elderly gentleman just walked straight out in front of me. And before I knew it, he was right there on the edge of my bonnet. And I hit the brakes hard, and the car skidded round, but he walked safely from one side to the other. And of course, I wanted to shout out the window, but as you know, in those days, you got to whine the window. So by the time I could be abusive towards him, he'd long gone. But I shouted out, what do you think you're doing? And he turned around and he didn't even know anything had happened. So there we are. But had I have been, perhaps rather than doing 30 miles an hour, doing 40 miles an hour in a 30 mile zone, or even 50 miles an hour, what if I'd got my music up loud on the radio and I wasn't paying attention, or even drunk at the wheel? What do you think? Is that God letting it happen? Or is that on me? You know? So there are issues there. But that was interesting. God takes responsibility. Well, let's just have a look very quickly. I want to just share with you three things this morning. First, God needed to free his people. He freed them. Then he needed to feed them, then he would ultimately lead them. And they certainly needed some leadership, didn't they? So let's have a look at the first one then. There we are. He needed to free them. And it says there, but Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. Lord, he said, why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hands. So let's have a look at that. Now it's interesting, the first thing that God needed to do, obviously, was to free his people. Now it's interesting, as you go through the early chapters of the Old Testament, there's a kind of strange morality going on there that doesn't always seem to make a lot of sense when you think about it. And so what I've done is I've just labelled some of these up just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. Lies and deceit brings God's protection. Now you'd say God isn't like that. That isn't in the Bible. Lies and deceit brings God's protection. But it's interesting, Abraham and Sarah, isn't it? They had to go down to Egypt to try to get food because there was a shortage of food. As we know, whenever God's people went out in search of food instead of trusting God, it always led to trouble. It always led to problems. And of course, there's Abraham. He goes down to Egypt with his wife Sarah. And we're told that Sarah was a beautiful woman. Even in older age, she was still very attractive. I've got a quote here from Coco Chanel. Anybody buy anything from Coco Chanel? This is what Coco Chanel say about beauty, okay? Nature gives you the face you have at 20. Or it's God-given, if you like. Nature gives you the face you have at 20. Life shapes the face you have at 30. Life. But at 50, you get the face you deserve. Anybody agree with that? Oh dear, oh dear. I'm sure there's something to that. I mean, if you spend your whole life frowning, that's going to impact on your face, isn't it? What do they say? Turn that frown upside down. So there we are. But Sarah, even in older age, was very beautiful. Genesis chapter 12, and I like this, I think this is very good. Genesis chapter 12, Abraham turns to his wife Sarah and says, I know what a beautiful woman you are. Have any of you ladies ever heard that from your husbands? Or have any husbands heard it from their wives? You are handsome, or something like that. So there, I know what a beautiful woman you are. And of course, you know, or you could say to yourself, couldn't you? Look in the mirror tomorrow morning, I know how beautiful or how handsome you are, because obviously that's the way that the Lord sees us. And they went down to Egypt, and you'll remember Abraham passed his wife Sarah off as his sister. And the Pharaoh, presumably, who could just pick off any woman that he took a liking to, saw Sarah, brought her into the household, into the palace as his wife. Abraham passed her off as his sister rather than his wife. And we know what happened. The whole of the palace became infected with disease. And when the Pharaoh realized what had happened, at that time, Abraham was being treated well, wasn't he? We're all one big happy family. But when the Pharaoh realized what had happened, he turned to Abraham and he said, what is it you have done to us? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Now, it's interesting to me that Abraham lied, Abraham deceived, but the Pharaoh and his household got it, got the wrath of God. So there we are. Lies and deceit brings about God's blessing. Here's another one, just quickly. There we are. Two wrongs make a right. Now, that's never in the Bible, is it? We wouldn't condone that. Two wrongs, it's two wrongs don't make a right. Well, of course, we know that his son Isaac and his beautiful wife, Rebecca, did exactly the same thing several years later. Go down to Egypt to get some food. Rebecca is not my wife, she is my sister. Welcome, everybody. We're all one nice, big, happy family. There we are. Isaac lied, Isaac deceived. And who was it who got it? The Pharaoh, once again. Disease upon the whole household. Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? And there we are. The whole sad, sorry tale goes on again and again and again. It's a bit like the parable of the workers in the vineyard. You remember that they all got paid the same wages, even though some of them had only done an hour's work. And they complained and said, this is unfair. But it was more about the generosity of God than it was about the wages, wasn't it? What does it tell us in the Bible about wages? The wages of sin is death, isn't it? But there we see a generous God. Because, of course, all these people were living under grace. And grace changes the dynamics of a situation. We know that Satan will accuse us. Satan is the accuser of the brethren. You don't deserve to be where you are. You don't deserve to stand. You don't deserve to be this. You don't deserve to be that. And he's probably right. However, grace says, yes, they do. Because it covers everything off. So there we are. Although there's lies and deceit going on here, we never get the impression that God necessarily condones it. Well done for telling lies. Well done, thou faithful servant. But that's what we see. Here's another interesting one as well. There we are. Don't let the punishment fit the crime, Simeon and Levi. This is a sad one in many ways. We know, of course, that Jacob had 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel, and one daughter, Dinah. And Dinah went wandering off into the fields one day in the lands of Shechem there. King Hamor was the king of that land. And, of course, his son Shechem took her and sadly raped her. Awful situation there. And of course, there we find Jacob wanted to find a way forward, and King Hamor wanted to find a way forward. But we are told that Simeon and Levi took the law into their own hands and butchered the whole of the inhabitants there. Of course, King Hamor, to all intents and purposes, seems to be a reasonable person, but his son there, Prince Shechem, was something completely different. In the Apocrypha, that bit of the Bible that the Roman Catholics and Orthodox Christians like to keep in, it's got a wonderful book there, a wisdom book, Sirach. And I think it's in chapter 30 of Sirach. It gives wisdom teaching about how fathers should bring up their sons. And it actually says how to bring up a son that you can be proud of. It actually says more than that, how to bring up a son that you can boast about. Boast about, it says. Well, I think King Hamor could have done with a little bit of teaching there from the book of Sirach on how to bring up his son and his son's behaviour. So we see there that Simeon and Levi end up butchering the whole of that tribe, that people, looting everything that they've got, completely disproportionate to anything that had happened. Horrible as it was, disproportionate response. So we have a punishment that doesn't fit the crime. Let's just have a look at the next one. Lies lead to blessing. Of course, you'll remember the two wonderful housewives, and they did such a wonderful thing protecting the Hebrew babies and basically saying to the Pharaoh, telling lies for all intents and purposes, that these Hebrew ladies give birth much faster than the Egyptian ladies and we can't get there fast enough. But of course, what they were really doing was protecting those people. And we're told that God blessed them as a result of that. They were blessed. So we see some strange morals here. We don't always see God condoning them, but we do see certain patterns of behavior. But what God was about, fundamentally, was about freeing his people. Not just freeing them physically, but freeing them up from all of the things that has happened in the past. These, of course, are anecdotal examples, but they're examples that show us God's put those in there for us to learn about the behavior and the situation they were dealing with. Freedom. You and I, of course, are fortunate enough to live in a world where we enjoy freedom. But have you ever been trapped in a certain situation? Have you ever been trapped? I don't just mean being trapped in the bathroom. You know, who hasn't repaired this door handle yet? Well, that would be me, okay? I was once trapped, and it was quite scary, actually. I was at work, and I just started at the University of Birmingham, and it was Christmas, and you were going to have 10 days off Christmas holiday, which is the longest holiday I'd had since I was back at school, you know, for Christmas. And so they had a little party in the afternoon before we broke up, and I had a plan. I thought, what I'm going to do is I'm going to work till quite late into the evening, get everything cleared, all done, and then there I am. I'm off for 10 days for Christmas. I haven't got to worry about anything. Great plan. So we had the nice little do in the afternoon, and then I worked up until about 8 o'clock in the evening. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to head off home now. So went out, locked up, the big doors closed behind me, and then I'd go down to the stairs to the big main doors, open up, and off I'd go for Christmas. Well, of course, the doors electronically locked behind me, went downstairs to the big main doors, pushed them to go out, and guess what? Locked. I was trapped. Now, it's interesting, you go through a few personal emotions there. The first thought is, I'm not really trapped. You know, that would just be silly, wouldn't it? So I went up, I couldn't go back because the doors had locked. So I went up to the first floor, try and open those doors. No, they're not opening. Went up to the second floor, no. Third floor, no. So that's the first thing. You sort of perceive, well, I'm not really trapped. Then you go into a second emotion, which is kind of, I am trapped, you know. What do I actually do about that? And it's a little bit worrying, I suppose. I rang my line manager, my boss, to see if I could get out, and she wasn't answering. So I rang somebody else. They didn't answer either. Somebody else, you know. Eventually, and it wasn't a very good signal, eventually the fifth person that I rang picked up the phone. And there's almost like a huge sense of relief. Experience number three, somebody's on the end of the phone. A lovely man by the name of Richard, always really helpful, Richard was, delightful guy. He could have almost have had the word friend stuck on the front of his forehead with a post-it note. Do you know those kinds of people? I bet we're all like that, really, aren't we? Yeah, friend. And of course, he gave me the emergency number for the security. And within 10 minutes, the doors were opened. And I was free again. Now, I bet the Israelite people, when they were first put into captivity, probably thought, this won't last very long. This will soon get sorted out and we'll all be free. But of course, as the years progressed, they were trapped. So there we are. There's probably a deeper question there of, if the light's on and somebody's working in the office, why is everywhere all locked up? And of course, the answer I found out later was, if you're staying late, you don't go that way, you go that way. You know. Well, it would have been nice to have known that before. Lesson number four, I never, ever, ever did that again. You know, and that's something about the law. Health and safety laws like that, how do you stop that ever happening again? But the first thing God needed to do was to free his people. Second thing he needed to do was to feed his people. It says Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands, and they were inscribed from both sides, front and back. Here's another interesting set of morals. Hard work doesn't pay. Surely that's never in the Bible, is it? Esau. I have to say, I feel very sorry, personally, for Esau. There he is. He's hardworking. He's a skillful hunter, cunning hunter. Brings back the food for the whole family every day. There he is, working away. And he comes home and he's starving. Now, of course, if we came home from work starving in 2024, you could grab a biscuit or a piece of cake or, what was it, a finger of fudge, just enough until it's time to eat. Esau hadn't got any of that. He could grab a few berries off a tree or something like that, completely unsatisfying altogether. And he comes in, he's starving, of course. Esau, hardworking, not necessarily bright, I might say, but hardworking. And there he is, and we know the story, Jacob, and he gives up his birthright for a plate of broth and all the rest of it. I often wonder where Jacob's mother was, you know. Why wasn't she making him his tea? You know, there you are, Esau, you lovely hardworking guy, feeding us all. You know, why is he in that situation? Also, I suppose, another thing as well, we don't actually quite know what Jacob's job was. It says in Genesis 25, it says, Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. I don't even know what that means. It doesn't sound to me like he was a hard worker, a grafter. We'd say these days he was a skiver. You know, one's doing all the hard work. I know what I'd be thinking about Jacob if I was Esau, his brother. Who does all the hard work around here? But God didn't want a lazy Jacob. Over 14 years, God broke that man spiritually and physically, and we know he limped afterwards. And Fortunately for us, God doesn't say, I want them at that point in time. He says, I want them at that point in time. There we are. Just a couple more. Free will revoked. The Pharaoh is always an interesting one, isn't it? God said about the Pharaoh, I will harden his heart. Now, you and I sign up to the principle of Jesus died for everybody, for the whosoever. Anybody can come to know the Lord. But the Pharaoh serves as a warning to all of us that you can get yourself into a place where you can't get yourself back. And it says 25 times, I will harden his heart, or he will harden his own heart. And there's a warning for humanity there that Jesus died for all. But you can get yourself into a place where you can't get back. Be warned, I suppose. And then the last one there. God can't make his mind up. God knows everything. He's omnipresent. He's omniscient. Of course he makes his mind up. Well, the first message that Moses has is, let my people go. Then it's, let my people go for 3 days into the wilderness. And the Pharaoh actually tries to negotiate, doesn't it? You can't really negotiate with God, but can you just send the men? What about the women? The animals? Leave your possessions? He's trying to find a way forward. But you can't, of course, negotiate with God. But God would feed his people. But they did do a lot of grumbling. I don't know about you, but I like a good grumble. Do you? Get it off your chest a little bit. Share the misery around. A problem shared is a problem double, isn't it? Share it about a bit. Grumble. And of course, these people grumbled a lot. They grumbled mainly about food. They grumbled mainly about all kinds of different things, but they were in the desert after all. I sometimes grumble if I open the cupboards and things fall on top of my head, like Tupperware. I don't know how much Tupperware you need in a house. It's a bit like one of those old maths tests, isn't it? You open the door, get one piece of Tupperware out, and 14 fall on the top of your head. How many pieces of Tupperware were there altogether? Too many is my answer. Or shoes, tripping over shoes. Who's left those shoes there? Well, they're your shoes, you know, and that kind of thing. But grumbling. And of course, the people did do a lot of grumbling. It says they grumbled in their tents. They grumbled, the Lord hates us. They grumbled in the wilderness. They grumble, grumble, grumble. And there's Moses saying, how long will these people grumble? Of course, their grumblings were idealized. In the old days, things were much better. Grumbling can give you a disproportionate picture, can't it? Their grumbling was forgetting what the Lord had already done for them, and we can make the same mistakes as well. And of course, grumbling is negative, isn't it? Grumbling is not going to solve any problems for you. It's not going to find you a solution. Well, God had to free his people. He had to feed his people. And finally, and we're wrapping it up here, he would lead his people. The Lord replied to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. Now go and lead the people to the place I spoke of, and my angel will go before you. However, when the time comes for me to punish, I will punish them for their sin. But God would lead his people now into that place. C.S. Lewis once said, they didn't want a heavenly father, they wanted a heavenly grandfather with a long white beard telling them everything is going to be okay. And perhaps sometimes we're the same. Tell me it's all going to be okay. And that's a natural feeling in many ways. But they needed to be led as a people, leading into pastures of righteousness, leading not into temptation and all of that. Well, that's kind of everything that I wanted to share with you this morning. It must be time for lunch, hadn't it, now or something like that. But, you know, perhaps today you need to be freed from something. Perhaps there's something in your own life and you need to say, Lord, just free me from that situation. Perhaps we need to be fed. Lord, feed me with your word, feed me with your spirit so that I can understand more. And of course, we ultimately need him to lead us. Whatever our circumstance or situation, we need his leading.